Hello, this is the Business Marketing Club podcast. If you've heard us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. If this is the first time you've heard us, though, you're very welcome too. In each episode, we'll be offering insight and inspiration on a key current topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips for the business marketing community. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a business marketer, and I'm chair and co-founder of the Business Marketing Club Community Network. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Sarah Goodall, the founder of Tribal Impact, about how to address the challenge of employee advocacy. Plus, Heather Heefner, the principal at Dart Studio, will share some storytelling best practice. And head of marketing for the UK deals practice at PwC, David Nelson, and head of EMEA marketing of Crown Worldwide Group, Ayinda Bishi, will share their thoughts on how to recover from the COVID crisis. Ready, set, then let's go. Mobilizing your workforce to promote your organization is a risk. Mistakes happen. So how to avoid them? What is best practice employee advocacy? With me to address the challenge is Sarah Goodall, who is founder of Tribal Impact. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So first of all, tell us a bit about what Tribal Impact is and does.
So Tribal Impact is all about activating employees on social media, and that's all we do. So we don't manage social media channels, we don't do anything like that, but we do work with companies to help activate their employee voices on platforms like LinkedIn, Twitter, but actually to do it in a more holistic way. Because there's different employees within the different in the company that can do, for sales, for example, or leaders or experts or general employee community. But if you do it the right way, you don't have so many risks that you talked about earlier. So,
and I did kind of start off with I suppose, a glass half empty view of employee advocacy. Do you agree that it's a risk?
It can be a risk, but only if you don't do anything about it. Because my view is that your employees are on social media, whether you like it or not. They might not be during the work hours while they're sat in front of their desk or in front of their laptops. But actually, when they're in the coffee queue or if they're out and about, they're on the mobile device. They are on social media, whether you like it or not. So the ones that actually are at most risk are the ones that have got their head in the sand and are not actually facing up to it and doing anything about it. But the ones that are at least risk are the ones that have put social policies in place, given employees training, guidelines, support. Then you reduce the risk.
So that's risk reduction. But is it? I mean, regardless of trying to mitigate the downside, is it a risk that's actually worth taking? Is there an upside?
Absolutely. There is so much opportunity that you can achieve when you mobilize your employees on social media. For example, reach, okay? The reach of your employees, they reach far better quality, loyal, credible networks because people know them. It's all about the trust economy and people knowing others within their network. So they have better quality reach. Not only that, they tend to get higher conversion rates. So they tend to get higher click-through rates. They tend to get higher engagement rates than the brand channels. Generally speaking, whilst employees don't drive volumes of traffic to your website, they do drive the right people to your website. So we see a lot of our customers, whilst the employees are not up there in the top five in terms of sources of traffic to their website, when they look at conversion by source, employee driven traffic is definitely within the top five, in some cases the top one or two place. So employee networks, they're better quality, and they, whilst they might not give you huge reach when it comes to marketing, they get you good quality reach and higher conversion, and they're trusted networks, and mobilizing them have so much opportunity to reach bigger audiences, better quality audiences, and create much higher marketing engagement.
So you've convinced me that employee advocacy is worthwhile. I'm not sure you needed to, but you have. what is employee advocacy best practice?
So employee advocacy best practice, I think, well, if I start with the mistakes, where I see a lot of people go wrong is they get a tool and they launch it to their employees and say, go share. And this is a very brand-centric way of doing it, because what brands tend to do is fill it with brand content and they just ask employees to amplify the content. Now, that is not what employee advocacy is about. True, good quality employee advocacy, when you do it in best practice way, is when you actually take an employee-centric view of this. It's about helping your employees understand their voice, their connection, their purpose within the brand purpose, and you help them create a brand around that. Employees are not there as a distribution channel. That is not what they should be used for. When you collectively get the employee voice working together in a better quality way, that is true employee advocacy, because you're getting expert voices out there that actually fit into the whole brand picture. So I think that for me is where companies take an employee-centric view of advocacy, where they put the employees at the heart of it, rather than putting the brand and that the brand content at the heart of it. That's where successful advocacy happens.
So how about from a practical perspective? Which organizations are doing this well at the moment?
Well, I have to say IBM pioneered this years ago. They were one of the first companies to do this. SAP is another one. You tend to find that the tech brands actually are very good at this. They're quite advanced when you look at the, you know, in terms of where they're at in their maturity of advocacy. So looking to them is a good place to start. When I look at companies like SAP and IBM, they're all about putting their experts in front of the logo. They are not afraid of doing that. They're proud of it. They train their experts. That for me is best practice, and it's good quality. But other industries are catching up. So you tend to see like professional services industries, legal industries, there, you know, where they need to put their experts in front of the logo. This is where you're starting to see more of those companies to coming up through the ranks. And so looking at the tech brands is a good place to start if you're looking for best practice.
It does raise the question, though, as to whether advocacy is something for every business, or whether it does work best in say, the technology sector, or maybe there are particular sizes of organisation that it works better for.
No, I tend to disagree, because we have we work across, I mean, certainly in business to business, obviously, because I'm on your interview, but we have companies like in manufacturing, in telco, in the legal industry, which you typically wouldn't associate with being so digitally advanced. It does go across all industries, and large companies and small companies. And I'd argue, actually, we've just been working on some research actually, and the smaller companies, they're a lot more agile, they have the, you know, the right attitude, they have a bit of a growth mindset, a learning culture, they adapt faster, they can take this on board quicker. So, and I think they're a little bit more, they provide more freedom for employees to explore this, which so I think no matter what size of business or what industry you're in, you'll always have experts that are trusted for your customers, and they're the ones that you really need to start encouraging.
Sarah Goodall, founder of Tribal Impact, thank you very much. We're told that storytelling has become a powerful tool in the business marketing arsenal. But what exactly does that mean? I'm joined by Heather Heefner, who is the principal at Dart Studio. Heather, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So before we get started, tell us a bit about Dart Studio.
Well, Dart Studio is a presentation design studio. And what we do is we help corporations and individuals tell their best story. So many corporations have a big idea that they need to communicate internally or externally. We help craft that idea. And we create the speeches, presentations, and design them. Dart Studio also coaches leaders on how to present and how to communicate well.
Okay, so you're absolutely the person I should be talking to about storytelling then. And the way that you framed that there makes it sound to me as if you would see storytelling as perhaps more of an abstract concept rather than a concrete tactic. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's a very interesting question, and I think it's both.
Okay.
I do. The reason I think that it's more concrete is because of the recent brain research.
Right.
Which I find very interesting. And to be frank with you, it proves my case, which I appreciate all the time.
Well, that helps.
we all do, right?
So tell us a bit about this brain research.
Okay, thank you. So Dr. Uri Hansen, he's a professor of psychology at the Princeton Neuroscience Institute.
Okay.
Recently, he decided to study storytelling and what storytelling does to our brains. And so what he did is he put an fMRI contraption around the head of a storyteller and the same contraption around the head of the listener.
Okay.
And he scanned these people. He scanned their brains about what was happening when the storyteller was telling a story and when the listener was listening. And he found some phenomenal results. What he found is when different parts of the brain lit up in the storyteller, the same part of the brain lit up at the same time in the listener.
Huh.
Yeah. So for example, if I was telling you a story, Dave, it could even be something about my first prom. You know, that's what this woman did tell the story about it in this, you know, situation. When my prefrontal cortex lit up, yours lit up at the exact same time.
Hmm.
So he called this brain coupling. And so when we know that we have a connection with each other when we tell stories, and now we know that our brains are actually doing some of the same activity when we're telling stories.
Okay.
So that's pretty interesting.
That is interesting. What do you judge that to actually mean in terms of business results?
So what that means in terms of business results is when we are able to tell stories within business, so it could be a customer story, it could be a business success story, and the story needs to have some emotion in it, then the listener is able to connect and relate that experience to themselves. So it increases our emotion.
Okay, which increases engagement?
It does, yes. Actually, when our emotion is increased, another researcher, Dr. Paul Zak, talks about how our oxytocin is released when we hear a story. And right. Oxytocin, some people call the empathy chemical.
Okay.
And in his studies, he actually found that when stories were told for nonprofits, people donated more.
Wow.
Yeah, because especially compassionate kind of sad stories that pulled on people's heartstrings, the more oxytocin was released. He actually studied drew blood and studied their blood pressure and stuff. And for the people who had more oxytocin released, they donated more.
Okay.
So that's an interesting case for nonprofits and donating. I think it can be translated B2B, and this is not proven, this is just my own theory, that when we are able to tell stories of compassion and of results and of how we're doing good in the world, how your company is doing good in the world, even if it's for a profit, you know, many of our companies are excellent companies. We do phenomenal work.
Mm.
We also make money. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. But if we can talk about that place where we're really doing good, that activates people's brains and emotions. And the art of persuasion, you know, since Aristotle's day, we know is responding to we respond emotionally.
Interesting. So I wonder then if you can give us a practical example of good storytelling.
I love that question. I can. And So before I answer that question specifically, I want to say that there are different types of good storytelling.
Okay.
Is that okay?
That's fine.
All right.
Hello.
So there's what we call the origin story, and that's the story of a company, or it could be a value story.
Right.
And there's really great examples within that context of great storytelling. And I can tell you an example, give you one of those examples.
Okay.
There's also great sales stories where, and one thing that I coach at Dart Studio is we need to use the hero's model, the hero's journey model to create that story. And so it's not necessarily one singular story, but it's a formula of storytelling that can be very compelling. And there's also what I call a springboard story. And the springboard story is not my idea. It's by Dr. Stephen Denning out of Harvard. And it's a change idea story. So if you want to help someone look at how the new thing works, he's developed a formula that's quite effective. So I can walk you through those three and give examples for each one.
Sounds good. Give us an example of each.
Okay. So for the origin story, I love this one. All right, this is the Starbucks origin story. You may have heard it. Starbucks is not one of my clients, sadly, but this is a pretty popular origin story. And the reason I love this story, I will preface it, is because it almost all the people at Starbucks know about this. So this isn't really a B2B story. It's more of an internal story. But I think it affects B2B because it shows the ethics and the morality of Starbucks.
Yeah, I mean, they've used it a lot in internal communications, and internal comms is as relevant to a B2B organization as a B2C one.
Okay, great. So this is what the founder of Starbucks says, what he says. He says, on a cold January day in 1961, Fred Schultz, a diaper delivery serviceman, fell on a sheet of ice and broke his hip and his ankle. Fred's son, Howard, was 7 years old and vividly remembers the accident. That image of my father slumped on the family couch, his leg in a cast, unable to work or earn money, and ground down by the world is still burned into my mind, the Starbucks CEO once said. And at the time of the accident, the Schultz family was living in Brooklyn Housing Project. They had no health insurance, no workers' comp, no severance, and no way to make ends meet. Young Howard vowed that if he was ever in a position to take care of people, he would strive to make a difference in their lives. And since, he has started a company where they pay everyone's health insurance.
Right.
So that's an example of an origin story where the whole company knows it. And it sort of instills that value of we take care of each other and we follow through on our word.
Mm. It's interesting how it doesn't see it, you know, it doesn't kind of really fit with the sector that the business is in or the products that it sells at all. It just more gives you a sense of what the culture of the organization is like.
That's very true. And I think that's very important because especially our younger generation, they want to work for organizations that they believe in and that have healthy cultures. And that healthy culture starts at the top. And so if an origin story can have that type of ethics, it's beautiful. I actually recently did a workshop at Esri, and Esri is this huge map making company. They're mapping right now where coronavirus is and where different outbreaks are. They map where hunger is. They map where you just look up Esri, it's phenomenal. So I did a workshop for them on storytelling, and the class told me the origin story of their founders. And I have to tell you, Dave, everyone at this company loves working there. And I think part of it is because of their founders. So this is now a quite wealthy company. The founders, who are now in their 70s, still drive to work in their beat up cars because they're committed to the company. They're not committed to themselves. And their passion is making maps and showing people where pivotal information is. They're strong environmentalists. So they bought a whole swath of land along in California, along the ocean, for the sake of preserving it. And people know this story, and these stories about the personalities of these founders, and they are absolutely committed. And people there are very joyful.
Okay, so let's come on to the second type of story. Just give us a reminder of what that type is and then give us an example.
Okay, so the second type of story is what I think we all know, the hero's journey model, Joseph Campbell's model. Mm. And so it's not really a story per se, it's a method of developing a framework. And I can't show you all because we're on a podcast, but can you imagine a wave that goes up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. So if that's in your head,
okay.
The left, that's your presentation from left to right. The left is the beginning.
Yeah.
And you start at the down wave and you start with painting a picture of the current reality. What's the current reality of the situation? You can plug this into any children's book that you've read, say Cinderella. You know, she's a poor girl with cinders. Same with your own business model. You know, what is the condition of your customer? What is the condition of the market? What are the places of pain? This has to be very honest. And then the wave going up, you pull them to a new reality. You paint a picture of a new bliss. What could their world look like with your solution? And then there's a gap between the down wave and the up wave. The rest of that presentation fills in that gap with contrast, just like Joseph Campbell's model. So the contrast could be pain gain, problem solution, a story of a current reality and a future reality. Could be data points. You start to end on an upswing with a call to action, but you don't end there. You end at a very top wave, which I call the new bliss. What is the customer going to walk away with your idea implemented? And you let them leave feeling pretty high about the solution.
Okay. What's your example then?
All right. So for an example, last year we did this with Insight. It's called, Insight is the name of the company. And they sell computer solutions. They are a B2B computer software company.
Okay.
And we started with the problem of the competition and the problem of the changing customer experience and the strain that that was creating. And everybody could relate to that. That was true for the audience, for the business audience. And then the solution was that higher point, that new bliss, was we told a story of, you know, we painted a picture of how Insight solves this problem. Imagine a world where people, products, and channels can be connected seamlessly. And we painted a picture of that connected world that was absolutely seamless with the help of Insight.
Right.
So it started with chaos and it moved to a higher reality of this seamless world where everything was connected. And then the middle part of the presentation was filling in that gap of what are some of the problems that companies face and what are the solutions that Insight solves.
Okay.
So
okay.
For example, Insight solves security protection and code protection. Then there was a call to action of let's work together. And then the new bliss of when we work together, we will do these three things for you. How does that for an example?
That's a great example.
Makes sense?
No, it does. And you can see how you flow through that journey. It's the B2B Cinderella.
It's the B2B Cinderella. I love it.
So what's your third story type and example?
It's called a springboard story.
Okay.
And this is by Stephen Denning. And what it does is it helps people visualize a transformation that they need. It inspires hope. And it inspires change. So there's a formula. And that is, well, let me tell you an example first. Let me share with you an example and then I'll tell you the formula. How does that sound?
That sounds fine.
Okay. So this example was done for a client of ours. We work with Haagen-Dazs, and this was for the president of the shops, Haagen-Dazs shops.
Right.
He said, I have worked with local store owners for the He said, I have worked with a local store owner for the past 15 years. 10 years ago, in 2008, he implemented what he calls floor chats for his employees. He meets with them regularly to ask about their life, to coach them on their job, and to help them improve. He invests in them by listening and providing transparency about goals and objectives. He takes time to give them tools they need to meet their goals, and he gives them incentives. The result is that his turnover rate is lower than his competition and that his sales are high. He works from the value of respect. I think it's fair to say that most of our owners do not respect their minimum wage hires this way. As a result, our turnover rates are high and it is hard to find good employees. We want to implement the value of respect into all of our stores. It turns out that this soft skill has important business bottom line results and will help us run smoothly and efficiently on all levels of our business. So in that story, he's trying to change the culture in the Häagen-Dazs shops to a value of respect of everyone. Frontline workers, you know, the scoopers, the customers. So that was the context. So this is the springboard story formula.
Okay.
Number one, the transformative object needs to be clear. So the value of respect there. The story is true. That's very important. It needs to have a date and place that makes people trust that the story is true. It has a single protagonist. So in this case, there was the store owner. And the single protagonist should be generic, not someone's name, but like a sales rep, for example, because then other people can relate to that.
Right.
It should specify the alternative. So did you notice in that story, I said, many of our store owners don't do this. Mm. That wasn't supposed to be a shaming thing. It was supposed to be a, let's look at the contrast.
Right.
Strip out unnecessary detail, because people want fast, concise stories and yeah. people get lost yeah. in detail, and it has a happy ending.
So a lot of it really is about providing the groundwork for building trust in
yes.
the first place from which you can spring.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that word up, trust, because what I have found in all these storytelling methodologies, they all, if they're true, and can be communicated authentically, build trust. And with all internal strong cultures, there's an element of trust. And then from B2B, as if you're a business promoting to another business, there has to be that element of trust, mm-hmm. or people will not buy. People will not listen to you. It's just a human condition.
I think that's a good place to end this. Heather Heefner, Principal of Dot Studio, thank you very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The COVID-19 crisis has impacted every business. As we move into recovery, how can business marketing help business thrive again? I'm joined to discuss that by the head of marketing for the UK deals practice at PwC, David Nelson. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave.
So before we get going on the kind of topic of the day, perhaps you can tell us a bit more about, I think everyone's heard of PwC, but what PwC is focusing on right now. What's top of mind for you?
Sure. From a marketing perspective, our approach really continues to evolve as we move through the different phases in responding to COVID-19. We've recently moved away from what was a centralized campaign response to COVID, really because COVID and the broader challenges really provide the context for all of our activity going forward. One thing with that, though, is we are still very much focused on making sure we bring together our business lines in a centralized approach so that we take the best of the firm and don't lose the sort of collaboration that has really been a really key focus for us over the last few months. In the broadest sense, though, the firm is sort of leading the way in the safe return to offices, and exploring a more blended approach to working from home, office life, which is sort of being established now. And actually, I think throughout all of this, PwC has really stayed true to its purpose, which is building trust in society and solving important problems. And I think that's really shaped our marketing as well as we've moved through.
Okay, that kind of sets us up really neatly, almost as if we'd planned it for the topic that we want to talk about. So what one thing should leaders put in place as they return to work after the crisis if they want to ensure that their business survives, thrives and grows?
Yeah, so for me, this may seem obvious, but I think it's about leaders really focusing on getting closer to their clients. I think it's about really understanding the challenges they're facing, listening, supporting clients through what is such a challenging time for everyone. And I think ultimately it's okay to make these connections and reach out to clients and not have all the answers, which maybe people are used to doing in normal times, but essentially no one has the answers to these challenges. So I think it's about listening, working together to find solutions and also take the time to understand people's unique personal challenges that they're facing, and not to mention the number of business challenges that people will be overcoming over the next few months.
So I guess one of the challenges with doing that is there are a lot of people who will be kind of chomping at the bit to do something, and kind of, I think what you're almost advising there is kind of hold back, you know, take the time to take stock and talk about and listen to others. So I'm going to have to ask you, well, I guess firstly, why? Why should we take stock? We've been going through this for months already. Shouldn't we just jump into taking some action? And then secondly, I think it's all very well telling people to take stock, but kind of how? Is there a kind of process that they could put in place to make this happen? So why and then how?
Yeah, so in terms of the why, I think I saw a report from Source actually this week that reaffirms what I'm sure many marketers will know, that in a time of crisis, organisations are looking to those they trust the most and aren't necessarily looking for new providers or new suppliers during the time. So I think it really shows that sort of really understanding your client's individual situation is more important than ever. And we did our Strategy Ands team recently launched a thought leadership series on where next after COVID, and what that showed is that the opportunities and the challenges are really so unique within subsectors of industries and again ultimately individual organizations. So there really isn't a one size fits all approach to making this work, and I think it's about taking that time to really get to the heart of what matters to clients.
Okay, so that's the why bit. Let's come on to the how.
So for us and the work we've been doing, we've really focused on practical guidance, really genuine pieces of advice that our clients will help our clients to move forward, essentially. Our clients actually have given us direct feedback to your point on how noisy things are at the minute. And they've said to us, if unless you've got a genuinely differentiated point of view, then don't bother. So I think it really is about bringing the best of your organization to clients, focusing on the right content and channels that are relevant and timely. And we've spoken about speed, and speed has been a real focus because people are time poor at the minute, but at the same time, the world is changing rapidly. So I think there's this balance of responding to issues effectively, but only doing so where you have a genuine value to add, and not feeling like you should just be doing things, but actually doing stuff that really, really makes a difference and draws on the best of what you've got to provide.
Can you give an example then of where this approach has made a difference in your experience to a particular business?
Yeah, so, well, we've had really fantastic feedback from, I guess, the quality and timeliness of our COVID response and communications, and it's covered a huge variety of forms. There's been a big focus on sales and marketing collaboration with that, and really making a difference. And for us, just a couple of examples that have worked really well. We very quickly prepared a response to crisis guide that helped clients understand the potential scenarios that they may be facing in that uncertainty, but then also to help identify some of the red flags for their individual organization and how they need to prioritize acting and dealing with those. So again, a sort of really valuable output to that engagement. And so I think that's a really great example of where people have had value. But also we launched a podcast, which is just a great way to provide that practical advice and guidance and opinion, but on what really matters to clients and in a format that really works for them. So I think again the feedback has been great, and it's really for me something I'm sort of proud to say that clients feel supported through this time. I think that's really important.
That's a great example. And obviously a podcast is a terribly good idea. Head of Marketing for the UK Deals Practice at PwC, David Nelson, thank you very much. I'm joined now by the head of EMEA Marketing at Crown Worldwide Group, Ayinda Bishi. Ayinda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, you should tell us about Crown Worldwide Group and what they do.
So Crown Worldwide Group is a group of companies. We're global. The company has been in operation for over 50 years. And, you know, it's a group, as the name connotes. And within the stable, we have six very strong brands. Okay. Across, you know, diverse sectors. So we have two mobility brands, one across the privates, one across like corporates. We have a brand that works with fine art logistics, so like museums, galleries, and private collectors. We have another brand that works with office fit outs and interiors, which is called Crown Workspace. And then we have the records management side, which is, you know, does what it says on the tin. You know, we store your records, we do all the digital services as well. And we have the Crown Wine Cellars, which, you know, the best bit, where you get to keep all the very, very expensive wines and all that. So it's very diverse. So I head up the EMEA part of the business. We're in APAC, you know, US and EMEA. So my remit covers all the EMEA countries, different stakeholders, and all these brands are represented in this repertoire of countries.
Now, there's multiple different sectors encompassed within that. So you have the real diversity that makes your answer to this question kind of really interesting, I think. What one thing should B2B marketers put in place as they return to work after the crisis, if they're to help their business survive, thrive and grow?
I think, you know, I really thought about this question, and I'm not sure there's really a one thing. So my question is, it's one answer, but it's a three-pronged approach.
Because I think
we kind of need to be realistic that it's really much more than just turning the lights back on. Right. You know, it's, you know, some things might never really return to the way they were before, ever, ever, ever again. And some things might come into the, you know, in new entrants to how we work as marketers. And, you know, some things might be still here in some shape or form. So I think what we really need to do is reflect, re-engage, and reboot. So those are my three R's, which is one thing. You know, and I think it does what it says on the tin. You know, when you reflect, you know, you really do think, because as most marketing professionals, they will tell you, we have been on a roller coaster, on a hamster wheel for the past 4 months. It has been relentless. You have to keep thinking, you have to keep pivoting, you have to work with your stakeholders, you have to really think outside the box. I think we have done more thinking outside the box, well, I have anyway, in the last 4 months, than I have done in my entire, you know, 18-year career, you know, which was good because it pushes you in ways that you wouldn't think that you'd ever be challenged. So there are lots of challenges on there, but I'll save that for another podcast.
Okay.
But I think when you reflect, you have to think what worked and what didn't work. You know, yeah, we've done, put different things into place. I know you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, around March time, it was just, you know, get the comms out there, let people know. But then there was kind of a tipping point on, are we actually spamming people? You know, people are having, you know, information overload. So there was really things like that. So I think as marketing professionals, we need to look at ourselves and things, you know, what have we done well? And, you know, what have we done not so well? You know, we're not perfect. So we need to stop, like, take that on the chin and know that maybe we could have done, you know, some things better. So I think that's the reflecting part of it. And then we need to re-engage with our internal and external stakeholders, because we have, as I said, been just thrown into the deep end in terms of what we're doing, what we're having to think about. So sometimes you kind of lose focus of what of your why sometimes. So you kind of need to re-engage with your audience out there to let them know that, you know, this is what the business is now. You know, things are not the same. So it's still that same of constant communication, but now in a more strategic, forward-thinking way. For me, what I've been telling my team in the last few weeks is let's start to tease our comms away from, you know, COVID, the impact of the pandemic and all that, and start to think of, you know, business as usual, whatever that means, you know, in whatever ilk or form. So that's trying to re-engage. And it could be using all the channels we have, you know, content, social media, lots of videos. What I find that have really worked is videos now, because everyone's at home, everyone's really anxious. The human touch, you know, when someone's talking to you, you need to see their face says a lot of things more than what they're actually saying with their mouth. So I think that's really, really helps. And it helps you humanize and personalize the brand to a large extent. And I think the last thing to do is just to reboot. And just to reimagine, you know, before we say we're going back, you know, whatever that means, in whatever shape or form, the new normal, that phrase that drives some people crazy. What exactly are we going to do? We're not just going to pick up the plans that we made in January. You know, there's no way they're not going to be fit for purpose anymore. Things have happened. You know, budgets have been strained. You know, resources have been strained. We've had to pivot on a lot of things. So that's, you know, being there. So reimagining and rebooting is just still being out there, seizing all those opportunities, but more than anything, being sensitive to what's happening out there. This is time to have a bit of sensitive marketing, because yes, we're all marketing professionals, business leaders, we want to make profit, we want to get our businesses approach, but we're all people. We have all gone through things that we've never gone through before. So even the hardest man would tell you that this has knocked me for six. So we need to be sensitive in what we put out there. This is not the time for aggressive tactics, because it will just put people off. You know, so I think that's, you know, for me, are the things that people should start to think about once, as we're starting to go back to the new normal.
I like your three R's, but let me challenge you on some of them and challenge you with the kind of why question. So we take reflect first of all. There'll be some people who will worry that reflection is basically just about paralysis. So an organization spending so long reflecting that it can't really go off and do anything as a result. Is there an amount of time that we should be spending optimally on reflection before getting into your other R's?
I think reflection is constant, really, you know, after any project, after normally in any normal, you know, sphere of life, you reflect anyway when you do anything. But I think now, you know, it's how long is a piece of string? It depends on the business. It depends on what you do. It depends on your audience. So, for example, if you work in the travel sector, you will really have to reflect, you know, if you work in a supermarket, you know, fast moving consumer goods. Maybe not so much, because, you know, you're still out there. There's still lots of demand, so you need to work. So I think it's not a one size fits all. You need to do what works best for you. And I think as marketing leaders, something you would know is that you just go with your gut instinct. Mm. you know, you know when it's right to just stop, to pause and just take stock of all these activities that has been happening, and then just say, you know, what's going to happen. And then you know when you kind of get to a point where, yeah, let's carry on. Otherwise, you're just going to be going on and on the hamster wheel and not making much impact. So, yeah.
And does that kind of sector application also apply to your point about reboot, i.e. there'll be some sectors that don't need to reboot at all because the horrible phrase new normal is very much the same as their old normal, exactly. Whereas there'll be some sectors which will experience quite a difference.
Definitely. There's some sectors that have never stopped. You know, their new normal is better for them because they're enhanced. You know, the demand has gone through the roof for, you know, many reasons. I remember a few weeks ago when we started working on things like hygiene screens, and I was saying, you know, this is a guy that produces all these perspex, and probably for years he's just always been plodding along, but now he can't keep up with his orders. So, you know, he hasn't got time to really reflect. This is not his time for reflection, do you get what I mean? But there will be other sectors where there's literally no demand. So I'll go back to travel agencies. Well, things have started to pick up again now, you know, airlines and all that. But really, you know, they really just have to start to think of how to diversify and really accept that this might really be it for some of the services they provide. So it's a difficult time for some sectors. And I think those marketing departments really have to be supportive of the business leaders in those industries.
And so then going to Crown itself, can you perhaps give us some examples of where your three R's have been making a difference to the way that Crown does its marketing?
I think for us as a marketing team, so I work in EMEA, so I can speak for my region. You know, with some of the countries, when the countries were in lockdown, you know, like total lockdown, we had some countries where we are in that they were in total lockdown, like 24-hour lockdown, you can't even go out. So for us, we really had to pause because our suppliers weren't working, you know, our staff weren't able to go out, you know, weren't able to do anything. So we really had to pause and think of, you know, what we're doing. At that point, what we tried to do was to find other ways to reach out to our audience. So things that they normally pay for, we thought of giving them like lots of thought leadership. So we had all the experts within the business that were just there. You know, this is a time for us to reach out and to show the human element. We're still here to help. We're a caring brand. It's one of our values. You know, so it's really start really, really trying to find those touch points, even in those difficult times. So I think we had a few instances of that. So we also have a fine art brand where, you know, working museums, galleries, you know, and you know how those were closed for a long time. So it was starting to find ways to connect with these people, with this, you know, institutions, even while they were like off work, so to speak. So there were quite a few things, we're not going into too much detail and giving specific examples that we did. I think the beauty of Crown is that because we have such a diverse brands in our stable, it was quite interesting. Some more than others, some were just still carrying on. You know, for example, where the workspace where we're doing the office refits, we had, you know, clients that just wanted to, you know, rethink, configure their offices, you know. So I think, yeah, it was quite interesting being in a company like Crown at a time like this.
It's great talking to you. Ayinda Bishi, Head of EMEA Marketing at Crown Worldwide Group. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it. That's all we've time for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, to Sarah Goodall, Heather Heefner, David Nelson, and Ayinda Bishi. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian, and Josh Bench. And most of all, thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers. And you can check out our other webinars, podcasts, events, mentoring, blogs, newsletters, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.